Blog Talk Radio.
In 1975, he directed Jaws. In 1978, he directed Close Encounters of the Third Kind. In 1981, he directed Raiders of the Lost Ark. And now, Steven Spielberg brings us E.T., the Extraterrestrial. We will witness the arrival, the search, the desertion, the fear, the discovery, the friendship.
I'm keeping you.
The secret, the love, the warning, the signal, the mystery, the danger. The intrusion, the wonderment, the enchantment, the hope. The connection has been made. Universal Pictures presents Steven Spielberg's E.T., the Extraterrestrial.
United. This is the second installment of our year-long six-part tribute to some of the great films of director Steven Spielberg. Tonight we'll be tackling E.T., and for those that missed it, a few months ago we had an in-depth investigation and celebration of Jaws, which was his first international hit, and we're pleased to bring you this show tonight. I am Jamie, and I have Jerry here right with me. Hey, buddy.
Hey, how's everyone doing tonight?
Yeah, excited about this. This is like, I read a quote years ago from someone that said, Spielberg should have won the Nobel Peace Prize for E.T.
I couldn't agree more with that statement, you know?
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. Especially when you consider the global implications of this movie, how he played it for the United Nations. He went overseas and played it for royalty, and it really does touch a universal nerve, and that's part of what we'll be discussing tonight with our guests. It opened June 11th, 1982, a real flash from our childhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it was a global, worldwide phenomenon, and the biggest movie box office-wise of all time before it was taken over by the re-release of Star Wars. But tell me, do you remember seeing it for the first time as a kid?
Yeah. I remember – all right, let me get into some details here. I remember in elementary school, a friend of ours, Lyle Clapper, went to go see it, that week. My mom took me to see it, the week after school let out, so this would be the middle of June. But he said it was just incredible. He was really just blown away by it, and I remember seeing it. I remember it was the first film I saw in a theater that I cried. And
yeah.
I couldn't stop crying after, my mom couldn't stop crying, and everyone in the audience. And I went to go back and see this with my one of my brothers and my dad. We took to see it with some friends of ours, and it was the same thing. Even my dad cried, which was if you know my dad, even today, that's something of a rarity. But then at the end of that summer, I took my brother Michael, my oldest brother, who I live with now, Michael, to see it, and he couldn't stop crying. And it was one of those films, you know, before that I had not been to the theater to see a movie that elicited just such a universal reaction.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing, that's the first thing I take away with. But the other thing I take away, Jamie, is that it's timeless. You know, you're watching this right now, I think, and it doesn't feel dated at all.
It doesn't. And you know, they did the 20th anniversary reissue where they kind of remastered it. They put in extra stuff and did.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah, slight CGI. This was in 2002.
Right.
This is a case where CGI cannot improve upon the original. And it's fascinating in that your heart goes out for what you know intellectually is a man-made creature, is a puppet.
Right.
You know,
it's the same with the Star Wars films too that you,
yeah.
you spoke about, the remastered. You don't need any of that.
And it really is a lost kind of art. I mean, I think there's still people that do it to a certain extent, but when you have CGI, and I'm sure you could do it cheaper and quicker with CGI, it's not as realistic for a lot of studios to invest in the puppetry and that kind of thing.
Right.
But you believed E.T. And it was the way, and you'll hear this in the Alan Davia interview, it was the way it was lit, had a lot to do with bringing it to life. If you notice the backlighting, you don't really see E.T. just full-fledged and full light very often in the film.
Right.
Until you're already connected to E.T. as a real being. And it has a really interesting story behind it, how the movie came to be. I remember seeing it when it first came out with my mother and being incredibly moved by it. It took a long time to get on VHS, didn't it?
It was definitely a couple of years, and you know, we didn't even start renting movies till it became common, like 2 years after that came out was when it, when we started, like we joined a video club and everything. And I think it was maybe a year after that, like 85 or 86 maybe, that it came out on. I'm not sure. I'm not positive on that.
Yeah, it could have been something like 88. I think they made people wait a long time for it, and it was a limited time thing as well, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. You're right,
Yeah, and it was in the special green kind of packaging. And they
Oh, my God,
like,
I think I still have this somewhere really close by.
Yeah, and you could, that was great for a kid. I mean, you could replay it. And as the years go by and you recognize the craft behind how he achieved his effects, how he made it so effective. It's been spoken of a lot, telling everything from a child's point of view. There's lots of great stuff, and I'm going to start this first interview here. And there's great revelations in this interview, how E.T. came about, partly from Truffaut's suggestion, and how it's a really kind of autobiographical tale for Steven Spielberg. Lots of great nuggets of information in this conversation we're about to play. Joseph McBride is one of our top writers and teachers of film, and his books include Orson Welles, Hawks on Hawks, Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success, The Book of Movie Lists, Searching for John Ford, and of course Steven Spielberg, A Biography. This Emmy-nominated and Writers Guild of America award winner dissects Mr. Spielberg's fascinating rise to becoming one of our most accomplished global filmmakers, with a wealth of insights and anecdotes that will delight and fascinate all movie fans. In this conversation, Mr. McBride shared Spielberg's path to realizing E.T. and the religious overtones that might have made it one of the most beloved and popular films of all time. So enjoy the conversation. Here it goes. So we ended, we spoke about Jaws, and in between Jaws and E.T., we have Close Encounters, 1941, and Raiders. And I want to ask you, as a little primer leading up to E.T., the 1941 experience, obviously that was the first of his films, not that there's been very many, but that was less than commercially successful.
Well, Sugarland Express was not a huge flop, but it was relatively unsuccessful. So he had started, that was his first regular theatrical film, so he then recovered spectacularly with Jaws and made a gigantic hit. And it sort of spooked him, I think, in terms of doing downbeat subject matter, because he had angered the audience by casting Goldie Hawn in a tragedy. And in retrospect, I think the casting was problematical because she's very good, but people expected a very different kind of film from Sugarland Express. So when he came to 1941, he was riding high, though, with two big successes with Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And 1941 was totally out of control production. It was very expensive and very self-indulgent, and the whole thing was about excess in terms of staging and ridiculous overkill visually and dramatically and comedically, and it really went out of control. It was kind of a classic example of what can go wrong when a young director has a hit, and then the studio is given too much flexibility for his next project.
I find that there's a lot of the great directors of the 70s, which Spielberg has survived, obviously, and thrived more than any of them, really. There's always that one project towards the end of that period that is exactly like that.
Well, producers have sometimes said, you know, the time to get a director is after a flop, not after a success, because after a success, the director is impossible to control.
Right.
But after a flop, the director is trying to, you know, do penance. And that's what happened after 1941. But when he was making 1941, Spielberg was, you know, like a kid in a candy store, literally. And he was also, I think the fundamental problem with that film is that he was trying to do something he was not temperamentally suited for. He was trying to be one of the Animal House kind of Saturday Night Live wild crazy guys, and he's not a wild crazy guy. He's kind of a serious, somewhat square person compared to a lot of people in his generation. And the film was also made during the whole drug period, and Spielberg is not a drug user, but a lot of people around him were, including John Belushi, of course, who wound up dying of a drug overdose and reportedly was having some serious problems with cocaine during the shooting. And that happened to a lot of Hollywood films and caused a lot of delays and very slow productions because people were out of their minds, you know. So
yeah.
Spielberg was surrounded with some of that, too, and but he was trying to do this silly adolescent comedy, which, you know, is fine in some kinds of films. I mean, Animal House is a wonderful film, but when you couple it with World War II, it becomes problematical because I realized looking at the film, what, you know, I was trying to figure out where they went so wrong. It started with a real incident, which was the Japanese had shelled Santa Barbara with a submarine, and it was a minor incident. Nobody got killed, but it caused panic in L.A., and then a few days later, there was a false report of an air raid over Los Angeles, and everybody went crazy, and five people died of heart attacks and car accidents, and it was a kind of a, could have been a good idea for a comedy about anxiety and jitters having to do with fear of invasion. But they went overboard, and they had scenes of, you know, fighter planes flying down Hollywood Boulevard, which were great to look at, but ridiculous. And then the other thing they did that was seriously wrong was when I was researching that period, I realized that what was actually happening in Los Angeles then that caused part of the anxiety was the Japanese Americans were being sent away to the internment camps. And that was a very horrible and ugly situation, which reflected the fear of invasion and the fear of the other. And so Spielberg left that out of the film because there's nothing at all humorous about that. It would have been a very depressing film. But to leave that out falsifies the situation even more seriously. And he kept in the Zoot Suit riots, main character played by Bobby DiCicco is a jitterbugger, and they bring in the Zoot Suit riots, which happened a little later, but it was those had an ethnic component, that it was sailors beating up Mexican Americans, and they left that out of the film too, so it doesn't really make any sense. And it's sort of a film about World War II, which seems really stupid because it's divorced from the actual realities of the war. So it seems rather offensive as a result. And Charles Chaplin of the LA Times called it Spielberg's Pearl Harbor, which I thought was an apt phrase. You know.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty ill-conceived project from the get-go. And,
yeah. Well, that's the problem. You know, we say I'm a member of the Writers Guild, and we always say it begins with the script, and if there's a problem in a film, you can usually trace it back to the script, and ill-conceived is the perfect word. It was a film that shouldn't have been made, or should have been made much differently.
How did that change him, the failure of that film?
Well, he was chastised for going way over budget, and he realized that his career was in some jeopardy, even though he had such big hits, he could have, you know, made other films, but it sobered him up, and he was very depressed and embarrassed and demoralized, and the critics were merciless toward the film, too. And so he came back, and my friend Art Murphy, who was my mentor at Daily Variety, who knew more about the business than anybody I ever met, referred to Raiders of the Lost Ark as rehab. And Spielberg has recently begun saying that himself, that it was his rehabilitation program after the excesses of 1941. It's almost like even though he wasn't using drugs, it's like he was addicted to spending money and using the toys of motion pictures.
Right, right.
So Raiders was conceived as a very economical project, and it turned out to be exactly that.
And I do recall reading in your book that he was determined to bring Raiders in on budget. And for as well loved as that movie is, it was interesting to me to read that during the making of it, he became rather depressed. And I think the quote that you use in your book, he says he felt like he was losing touch with the reasons why he became a filmmaker. He wanted to tell stories about people and relationships.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Raiders, and I never was. And some people who've read my book like can't get around it. Like, why isn't this guy a fan of Raiders? I found it at the beginning a very depressing film because it's very soulless and mechanical, very well done, but a sort of mindless genre film in my opinion. And it's also rather brutal. To me, it was the start of the whole Reagan era, and the Reagan era was terrible for motion pictures. Hollywood started making sort of mindless, infantile films, which
yeah.
was a trend that had begun in the late 70s, but that took over Hollywood completely in the 80s. And Raiders is also, I think, a somewhat racist film in its portrayal of the Third World natives who were caricatured and brutalized in the film. And the scene that everybody thinks is so funny when Harrison Ford shoots a guy waving a sword, I always found offensive. And when I interviewed Lawrence Kasdan, who is the writer of the film, he told me that he finds that very troubling scene. He didn't write that, and he thinks it's racist. And the sequel, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, is flagrantly racist in portraying the Asian natives as mad, bloodthirsty savages. And so the third one, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, deals with that problem by having Nazis as villains, and everybody can be against the Nazis. So that film,
yeah,
that film it's more fun to watch. And I like the most recent film, which also I think gets around that problem. But they realize at a certain point that it's hard to find villains in today's more enlightened climate, and if you're not careful, you can mindlessly use foreign populations as stereotypical villains. They had a script that was set in Africa, and they realized it's just impossible to have African villains in a film. And, But all this problem is sort of built into the genre, which is a kind of retread of old 1930s and 40s serials and kind of stupid adventure films, which is not a very good genre to begin with, you know.
Well, you're not the only one, obviously, you know, this with that take on Raiders. I remember reading Pauline Kael's review of it, and I think she used the same terminology that you do in your book, that it's a terribly impersonal film, Raiders.
Yeah. That's what you were getting at when you mentioned that, you know, he was hungering for making something with some real emotion.
Right.
And I can really see that that was part of his drive to make E.T., and one reason E.T. is so wonderful. And, you know, the film had such an impact on audiences. I remember I first heard about it. I mean, I knew it was shooting, but the first person I talked to who had seen it was a little kid that I know who was deeply moved and was telling me I had to run out and see the film as quickly as possible. I waited a week or two to see it after the crowds were thinning just a tiny bit, and it was profoundly emotional for the audience, and it's still a very moving film. So
yeah.
Spielberg was connecting with his better instincts, I think, as a filmmaker with that film.
Well, a couple of things transpired to bring E.T. about, if I understand correctly. One was a suggestion from Truffaut, I believe, that he needs to make his movie about kids.
Right.
And the other was, as you write in your book, that E.T. was kind of a thinly veiled autobiography of Spielberg.
Yeah, a lot of things came together to make this film work. And Truffaut, who I knew, I used to see him when he would come to Hollywood. He would he kept telling me about this. He said, I would tell Spielberg, you got to make a movie about kids. He called it kids, you know. And I had the pleasure of telling Truffaut that Spielberg was finally making his movie about kids, but it was a kid and an alien, and Truffaut cracked up. He thought that was hysterical. But he correctly sensed that there was something childlike about Spielberg and that this would tap into his strengths, and that the children in his other films have been very good, and he should really focus on children. And he tried a project called After School, which Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale wrote. They were the writers in 1941. It was just a deplorable script. It was just full of stupid, very lowbrow humor that would have been embarrassing, and Spielberg had the sense to change his mind. It would have been like the 1941 of children's movies. So he definitely was tapping into some of his personal traumas. His major trauma, of course, is his parents' divorce. And I suppose even before that, it's the trauma of being uprooted several times in his childhood from one city to another as his father moved around. And he always felt his father was emotionally distant. And his mother is somewhat wild and crazy and a little scatterbrained, but in a good way. I mean, she's very creative. And actually, his father, who I interviewed for the book, is a terrific guy himself. He's a very thoughtful, creative man who I found out was an amateur filmmaker from the 1930s. And he and Steven started making films as a kind of father-son hobby. And Steven gradually took over because he was, the better filmmaker. So Stephen kind of underrated his father's involvement in his life, and I think it had to do with the events of the divorce, although even that was complicated because his friends told me at the time Stephen was angry more at his mother for the divorce, but it was a very disturbing event that he keeps replaying in film after film.
He really
and
does,
I,
yeah.
Yeah, again, I'll quote my friend Art Murphy, who at the time made a really shrewd comment on why E.T. was such a successful film. He said that Disney at the time was in very bad straits. They were trying to keep the market on children's films, but they were making very bad films because the executives were trying to replicate what Walt Disney had done in the 50s, and they were making sort of throwbacks to 50s films with nuclear families and sort of square family values. And Spielberg, as Murphy pointed out, incorporated divorce into the film, which was become very common in American culture, and, you know, maybe half the marriages by that time ended in divorce, and so it was part of the harsh reality of the situation, and the Disney people wouldn't have done that, but Murphy said if Walt Disney were alive in the 80s, he one of his strengths was he would always move with the times, and Disney would have had divorce in his films, but it was like a taboo in the 80s Disney films. So Spielberg opened the floodgates of emotion for a lot of kids and families about how you deal with broken families, and this boy needed a father figure. That's what it's really about. And he finds his father figure and friend in this alien who's supposed to be very old and wise, you know.
And he recited this story. I mean, he came up with a story himself, and he started reciting it to Melissa Matheson, who was married to Harrison Ford at the time on the Raiders set.
Yeah, that was the story that, you know, it's a little complicated because Melissa Matheson later filed a claim for part of the merchandising rights and successfully argued that she had come up with most of the descriptions of E.T. There was also a John Sayles script that Spielberg had been working on called Night Skies. It was about aliens, but it was a scary alien story. So I think the genesis of the film is, you know, as is true of a lot of stories, is sort of complicated. And Spielberg is not the sole auteur. I'm not doubting that he put in a lot of personal elements, but he certainly had help from Melissa Matheson, who wrote a wonderful script. It's a model screenplay, very simple and very elegant and beautifully put together. There are strange elements. I discovered after writing my book something very bizarre that contributed to the film. I found an interview with Spielberg when he was in college, and he said something to the effect that a lot of people like Antonioni films, but he said, I prefer to look at popular films like Disney's The Gnome-mobile. And I thought, wow, that's a strange comment. So I went out and got The Gnome-mobile, which I hadn't seen, just to see what he was talking about, and I was kind of floored that it was a big influence on E.T. One of the things I always thought was strange about E.T. is that it seems to take place in Southern California in a suburb, and yet it has redwood trees, which you associate with Northern California, and it seemed like this strange hybrid of Southern and Northern California. I couldn't figure out why he did that, but The Gnome-mobile takes place in a redwood forest, and it's about a bunch of little tiny creatures who live in the forest, like E.T. at the beginning of the film, and it's a lot of the visual ideas contributed to Spielberg's conception of E.T., and that's a Disney film from the 60s that was kind of ignored, and a strange film directed by Robert Stevenson, who was a good filmmaker who made Mary Poppins. So again, Spielberg has a lot of sources for his things that help him visualize his imagination and his fears and anxieties.
Yeah. What strikes me about the film is how it was embraced on a worldwide level, how he showed it to the president and his wife, how he showed it to the United Nations. Internationally, people really took this to their heart. First of all, why do you think it moved people so, and what did that international success do for Spielberg?
Well, it was one of those rare films that's, you know, like, why does The Wizard of Oz still move people so much? It's a wonderful film that really taps into some primal emotions about, you know, having to leave home and, you know, things of that sort, and being fooled and having strange friends, and, you know, it's kind of about growing up. And E.T. is about growing up, so it had that, you know, rare quality of simple story that tapped into strong feelings. I also think it has an interesting Christian parable aspect to it it was remarked on by a few people at the time, but it's very much like a retelling of the Christ story. It's about a creature who's discovered in a shed, and he has a glowing heart like the Sacred Heart. And he has spiritual teachings, and he dies, and he's resurrected after being persecuted by the civil authorities, and he returns to the heavens. And it's amazingly, you know, if you set out to create a Christ story for the modern world, you couldn't do it more clearly. And Spielberg said to Melissa Matheson when they were writing it, gee, we're getting into kind of sticky territory here, and they kind of decided to go with it. And he pointed out that it's kind of odd for a Jewish kid from Arizona to do this. But if you look at his work is full of Christian iconography. You know, like in Amistad, for example, the black captives, when they're in jail, they read a book about the story of Jesus, and he actually tells you the whole story with pictures in the film. And what I think that's all about is Spielberg grew up as a Jewish outsider in more and more WASPish environments. He started out in a Jewish neighborhood in Cincinnati, but his parents moved to areas that were sort of WASP suburbs, and Spielberg felt more and more alienated. And some people would become rebels and angry, defiant people, but his defense mechanism was to try to be accepted by the majority. And I think the whole interest in the Christian iconography comes from that, trying to sort of take on the cloak of the majority. He actually, there's a famous incident where he dressed up as Jesus one time around Christmas time and stood on his front porch. He says, anyway, his father doesn't remember this, but Spielberg was playing Jesus, which is very interesting symbolism. So I don't think he really believes in the Christian story, but I think it's appealing to him on an artistic and personal level. And I think some of that is in E.T., and I think that helps account for the... It's sort of a modern way of retelling an important religious story in modern terms with technology. And as I wrote in my book, Carl Jung wrote a book on flying saucers in which he said the reason we're hung up on flying saucers is that it's a modern form of religion for a technological age that doesn't believe in spiritualism but wants to believe in gods from the skies, is the way he puts it. So Close Encounters has a lot of religious aura to it, and E.T. is even more direct because, you know, the creature comes out of the god comes out of the machine.
Yeah, yeah. I just rewatched E.T. Last week, and I felt like a kid again. I felt like I was back there the first time I saw it. It's just, it's such a beautiful film, and the way he works with children, there's moments in that film that are so real with the children. How does he work with the kids? How does he get those performances from them?
Well, if you look at the Laserdisc, there's a terrific documentary about the film where he had a 35mm camera crew following him around when he was shooting it, which produces some of the best making of footage you've ever seen. And there's one particular scene where he's talking to Henry Thomas, who plays Elliot. And he's one of the secrets of Spielberg with kids is he didn't talk down to them. He talks to them as an equal. And it's partly because he easily taps into the childlike side of his personality, but he also realizes that kids are smart and they're, you know, not stupid, like some directors treat them as idiots. But Alan Dwan, who I knew, was a great old director, directed Shirley Temple several times, and he said, I asked him what the secret was of directing children. He said to treat them as adults, and that's what Spielberg does. He talks about emotions and ideas, and yet he also plays with the kids, like he would play Pac-Man with the kids, and he when he did Empire of the Sun, he got some remote-controlled airplanes to play with Christian Bale. So he kind of reassures the kids that he's on their level. He's not a authority figure. He's their friend, you know?
Right, right.
And that's what E.T. is about, right? I mean, it's about the kid having an adult friend and relating, because E.T. is sort of childlike. And so they find a common bond, and I think that's what Spielberg did with the child actors.
We spoke to the one of the screenwriters of Poltergeist last year, and he said it was surprising to find out that Spielberg actually had no hopes for E.T. He was placing all of his bets on Poltergeist, apparently.
Yeah.
So,
that's funny.
Yeah.
Well, it shows you never know. You never know what the commercial potential is. Huh?
Well, the screenwriter actually said he attended a screening of E.T., and he said, are you crazy? Are you crazy, Steven? This is going to be the biggest thing ever. I know there's some talk about his involvement with Poltergeist. Did he handle these two projects one on top of the other?
Well, they were in production at the same time. One thing about E.T. that's worth remembering, I was getting sort of secondhand reports on the production. I was aware of it being shot. He shot it under an assumed title, A Boy's Life, because he was very worried that somebody would rip it off. But I had the sense that this could be a very special project just from the way it was whispered about, and that it obviously seemed like a very personal film to Spielberg. So that was alone, I thought, a sign that this could be a special film. But you never know when you make a personal film, is anybody going to care about your personal obsessions? I think that might have been what Spielberg was wondering about. But it was a little film, and the magnitude of the success, I think, couldn't have been predicted. And Columbia Pictures actually passed on the film. They had the rights to do the film, and they let it go, which was, you know, in retrospect makes them look very idiotic. But it was not something that had big hit written all over it. It was quirky. And Spielberg made it for only $10 million, which was a small budget even at the time, and it was about half the budget of Raiders. And the point of it partly was he was trying to get out of his long-term contract with Universal. And if he had gone over $10 million, as he kept telling his crew, they would have him hooked for years. And as Alan Davio, the cameraman, said, Spielberg kept giving him speeches about, this is not about money, it's about my freedom, because they'll keep me a slave to them for years. And Alan said he would be directing Jaws 5 or something if he hadn't gotten out of the deal. So he tried to shoot it very economically, and the pressure was intense to keep the schedule. And that was partly also a reaction to the 1941 debacle. After, you know, with Raiders and other films, he was constantly trying to be efficient and fast moving. And I think he realized that's good for your artistic muscles to work fast and instinctively and not dwell on everything. And, you know, when you're around filmmaking, it can become a very slow, cumbersome process. And Spielberg's mind works very fast. I think he realizes that taking a lot of time is not good for him.
I think so. I think so. And I read where he thrives on the fly. I read where he doesn't storyboard the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan, and he shows up at the beach that morning, and it's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling.
Well, he has a tremendously fast mind, and that's why he's always working on multiple projects at the same time. And Orson Welles did that, and some people like to criticize both of them for allegedly being scattered, but actually it sharpens their perception to be multitasking. So I think there are times, you know, earlier in his career, he over-prepared and was, I think, a sign of defense against anxiety is to storyboard everything. Hitchcock is a classic example because he was full of anxiety. So you have everything under control. But then Spielberg decided to shoot E.T. without storyboards because he felt he would be more free emotionally and would have to respond to what he was finding on the set every day. And that seemed to liberate him, and he did that for certain scenes in Color Purple, too. And I think, as you point out with Saving Private Ryan, he's kind of loosened up over the years and trusting his instincts more and giving, you know, he has more confidence, perhaps, as a filmmaker.
Okay, that was Joseph McBride, Mr. Spielberg's biographer. A great conversation, a lot of interesting insights in there. He said something interesting, and I shared it with you, Jerry.
Yeah.
About Spielberg's framing. He's known, obviously, for great framing. Did he say it in that conversation? Because we had a conversation also about Empire of the Sun for a future episode.
Right. I don't remember offhand, but I remember us talking about that.
Yeah.
But it's something that you should definitely repeat, because I think it's definitely a worthwhile tidbit for a lot of people.
Yeah, especially for filmmakers. Somebody asked him, a novice filmmaker asked him, how do you decide what shots to use? And he said, when you watch your actors in rehearsal, wherever you find yourself standing, whatever position you're drawn in observing them, that's your shot. And it was so simple and so beautiful. And we speak of this to Mr. Davia in a little bit, how Spielberg is a traditionalist in terms of camera movement, camera placement.
Right.
He does use kind of off-the-wall lenses. But there's such economy and ingenuity in the activity in that frame, how you convey several ideas in one shot instead of it's a multi-purpose kind of shot. And that's especially true of his big epics, as we see in Empire and in Private Ryan, but
right.
Very minute human scale in some of these other movies, particularly E.T. Real fascinating conversation. We welcome everyone.
Yeah. A lot of stuff in there I had not heard. So right there, especially just the stuff, not so much about E.T. I mean, the stuff in there, it's really funny. I remember at the time when E.T. came out, and they were talking about the Christ parallels, I was like really kind of shocked. But my mom was like, "Yeah, it's got a lot of that in there."
It's hard to take that away from it. I mean,
yeah,
it's hard to
argue
that that's not in there.
Yeah, oh, it's definitely in there. The older you get, the more I realize that every time I watch it, and that's a good thing. I have no problem with that. I definitely see that. But the other thing is, I thought it was very interesting. As he brought up the whole thing of the 1941 and how that's, he really hasn't done another straight-out comedy since then.
Right.
And right. I wouldn't mind seeing him try it again at some point, but it's very interesting. I think, as you mentioned in the chat room, it is something that 1941 would have been better suited for Robert Zemeckis at the time.
Or Landis.
Or definitely Landis, yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he has such great comical moments in a lot of these films, and they're special kind of good-natured, joyous comedy. And even in E.T., when E.T. gets brought back to life and Elliot's pretending like he's crying to cover with the FBI guys or the government guys, and he sees the plant and he starts to laugh and he has to make those into tears again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's such a buoyancy to his humor, and Catch Me If You Can, and all these kind of, I think he could do a straight-out comedy without a problem. We have a caller. Caller, you are on the line. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Hey, how are you, sir?
Do you know if Spielberg was ever influenced by the shooting or the sets of West Side Story?
I haven't heard that, but I would imagine, as a student of film, he probably was. What makes you draw that comparison?
Well, because the way that he actually draws people in to make people feel as though the audience is actually there in in the scene. And West Side Story, to me, was one that always impressed me as being in the alleys or being in the gym.
Right.
And there are not too many filmmakers who can do that. I'm trying. Do you remember his TV movie that put him on the map?
Duel.
Duel with the truck. And the way that he had the camera placements, that to me, I didn't know. Nobody knew who he was at the time, but it was very impressive how he just used the cameras to bring forth the animation of an inanimate object.
Right.
That's
my
comment. It gave it a real menace, a sense of menace. That truck, and it's really a precursor to Jaws. He always saw it as like the prequel to Jaws in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like Jaws at all. But I
really?
Want to ask you.
Really?
Like
what didn't you like about Jaws? Just out
the
of
whole
curiosity.
Thing. I didn't like it. It didn't seem real. The only thing I did like about it was Dreyfuss's one particular scene in which he was talking to Shaw, and he crushed a paper cup, and I thought that was a tribute to Dreyfuss more than Spielberg.
Yeah, you're right about that.
Yeah, you are.
I didn't like Jaws. But I wanted to ask you guys a question.
Sure.
When Spielberg was, he was manic about trying to enter the world of Hollywood, and it's rumored that he would go onto the set going to the studio, actually, and just sit down at his empty desk and just visualize himself as being a director. And then eventually he got caught. Then they threw him out. Then he would come back. And then they hired him because of his persistence. How true is that, and what are the details of that?
That is true.
That is very true, yeah.
I don't think it's something that can necessarily happen today.
I think you'd be, like, locked up. Huh?
Yeah,
he used to
actually go on the Universal Studio tours, and then he used to jump off the tram, the tour tram there, and just walk in and observe directors working. He used to try to fill out as some kind of a crew member.
Uh-huh.
And he saw a lot of great stuff. I think he saw Alfred Hitchcock Presents show in production. And when it was his persistence, and he had a special something, and he was already making films, little short films, and he had an eye and a dialogue with these people. He was obviously a smart kid.
Mm-hmm.
He did an episode of Night Gallery with Joan Crawford.
That's right.
He did lots of TV, actually.
I didn't like that. I didn't like it.
Wow, you're a tough crowd. I mean.
Well, no, the one thing I liked about him was how he could take subtleties. Like, for example, when he did Schindler's List, and when, I forgot the, Liam Neeson?
Yeah.
When he was driving away, and how Spielberg took these people, the Jews who had to be stranded there, but how they, almost zombie-like, were looking at Nielsen as he was driving away, and how they crowded together to sort of fill in the vacuum as the car was pulling away.
Yeah.
That, to me, was no words, mm-hmm. but it was so impressive how the emotion, how they were so appreciative of this particular guy.
Well, isn't that also true? You mentioned emotion. The scene at the end of in Close Encounters where everyone starts coming back.
Mm.
These people have been gone for decades. Or even just days. That's a very emotional scene.
Yeah, but he had.
I don't care who you are. I mean, that's just as emotional as Schindler's List. I mean, there's these guys been gone. These World War II pilots who come back, and they've been gone 50 years.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, historically, in a way. But I mean, in terms of just being artistic and, you know, no, I didn't like that much. What I'm saying is that
you are a tough crowd.
I'm tough.
I mean,
I'm a tough crowd. I'm
Spielberg.
A tough crowd. But
you brought up a good point, though. And
but the music
goes,
was what, you know, gave it the impetus.
Williams' music always elevates Spielberg's
music
in a special
yeah.
way. You brought up a good point about that shot in Schindler, and it's what we were just speaking of, the way he fills the frame with activity that gives it an extra weight, an extra meaning. And it's also interesting, because, Jerry, you brought up the World War II pilots, and there's a common theme that goes through most of Spielberg's films, and it really does harken back to the devastation he experienced from his parents' divorce as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's conscious or not, divorce and separation really factor in a lot of these films, and particularly E.T. You know, the single mother and the father went away with another woman, and the hurt that brings those children and that mother. When actually, it's interesting, I think he kind of demonized his mother at that time. He blamed his mother for that at the time.
Do you know of anybody who didn't cry at E.T.?
I dare anyone.
I think Ahmadinejad did not cry at the end. Ahmadinejad and Chavez did not cry at the end. But okay, otherwise than that, though, I think everyone else did.
I went twice to see it because I took, I had two dates. So I took both of them to see. They both cried, and this is the second time for me. And I was, you know, I'm holding back tears. And you know, it was just such a simple yet effective way of displaying how humans can actually relate to an ugly little creature.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, and how
right,
as children they could do that. As children they had the open heart and the mind to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But as an adult, too, I mean, it shows that if, you know, humans who are corrupting this world, destroying this world, still have something within us as adults to try to reach out or at least be affected by this ugly little creature who couldn't speak, and it was very, very effective. And, you know, the fact that the creature with the lighted finger was communicating with, I forget the actor's name, but with the kid, but how it showed that there might be a bond there between us sometime. Maybe I'm over, maybe I'm overdoing it, but
not at all.
On an existential level, who knows?
I think it is a movie about peace.
It is.
A very strong statement on that, and it takes seeing things through the eyes of a child to realize that, to really hit that home. And I think that's why it was a perfect vehicle for Spielberg. He wanted to make a movie from a child's point of view, from that wondrous, when they looked at the world as a wondrous new thing, and Spielberg was able to do that himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think audiences, when they saw the movie, felt that same way. It was almost an out-of-body experience. I understand the religious connotations, not necessarily with the Christianity or any kind of organized religion, but in terms of being kind of a heartfelt, out-of-body kind of experience, where everyone felt as one watching this movie and experiencing it together. What movies should do.
Well, yeah, and, Spielberg. I also like, I just forgot his name. He's another one of my favorites, which I thought would be great if they teamed up together. But this one, because what I like about this other guy is that he can take a rather bland scene and with different shots and with music. The guy who was the producer, the executive producer of Armageddon. He has TV shows on now.
Bruckheimer, yeah.
I would have thought that those two would have been, a good complement of one another if they could actually get their egos together and not, try to wonder who's going to be number one.
It's interesting who Bruckheimer chooses to work with, and he very seldom works with, the top flight directors when they are top flight. He usually shepherds careers, and he did that with Adrian Lyne and Tony Scott,
Michael Bay,
the beginning.
He's vastly different than Spielberg. Spielberg will get the emotion from within, while Bruckheimer is very good at using camera angles and music to stir up an emotion that isn't really something that's personal, something that one can relate to one on one, but can relate to the scene, the action of the movie. So I thought, because the way that Bruckheimer did. Was Bruckheimer involved in Private Ryan?
No. Not to my knowledge, no.
There was one.
His version of Private Ryan was Pearl Harbor.
That's right.
Good one, Jamie. Good one.
Yeah. But his camera scenes to me are.
Yeah.
He and Spielberg to me are the best.
Yeah.
The best.
They're both great minds. What's your name, sir?
Joe.
Joe, I appreciate you calling in, man.
Sure.
I appreciate you listening.
Yeah, thank you, Joe.
Sure, no problem.
It's been a lot of fun, and we welcome you to listen as often as you want, and we thank you so much.
No problem. Take care.
Thank you, buddy. Bye-bye.
Thank
bye-bye.
You.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Some good insight in the Spielberg. And speaking of good insight on Spielberg, you ready for this Alan Davia interview?
Yeah, definitely.
Talk about a great artist. Here we have an artist who's... He's responsible for creating some of the most awe-inspiring imagery. You look at Empire of the Sun, The Color Purple, Fearless. What a great movie.
Yeah, I know, I'm with you. Don't worry. You don't need
Bugsy.
To tell me.
Bugsy, man.
Dude, Bugsy was a good movie. I don't care what anyone says. Bugsy was a good movie.
Love Bugsy.
Yeah,
and just the moment behind
the... haters out there. They're haters.
The shadows behind the screen there. It's just the imagery is amazing in his films, and of course he shot E.T. as well. He's a masterful filmmaker, and more than a few of our favorite movie moments have been created by this man. And actually, he's involved in the Empire of the Sun tribute in January as well, and I got to tell him my favorite sequence from any film I've ever seen is from Empire of the Sun.
Right.
It's the most kind of awe-inspiring imagery I've ever seen. So I got to thank him personally for that. That was a big thrill for me. But here, for the purpose of this show, we spoke to Davia about his experiences on E.T. and what he thinks set Mr. Spielberg apart. And here goes Alan Davia. First of all, I wanted to ask you about your beginnings with Mr. Spielberg, because you were there from really the beginning with Amblin.
Right. Well,
I
met Steven in 1967. And that was when he was searching to do his first 35 millimeter film. See, he learned something very early on. he was gatecrashing Universal, and he would show them some of the films that he had done, and I remember one 16-millimeter film that he did that was really, I thought, terrific. And you know, but he said he would run these 16-millimeter films in on the big, you know, one of the screening rooms on the big screen there, and it was very nice, and people say, oh, that's very good, you're very talented, and they sort of pat him on the head and say, someday you're going to be a real director. Well, that didn't go over very well with Stephen. And so it was the kind of thing he said, suddenly, you know, he realized that if he was going to be taken seriously by these executives, he'd have to fill that screen. So he knew he wanted to shoot in 35mm. And a friend of his named Ralph Burris had inherited some money and agreed to donate it so that Stephen could make a film, which was a bicycle racing film called Slipstream. And it was about European-style bike racing. And Stephen, being the thorough person that he is, had gone around and organized a whole group of European-style bicycle racers, and they had agreed to come out and be in the film for nothing. And it was all set up to shoot on weekends. And literally, we would all arrive in the middle of the night and start blocking scenes with the headlights, of course, you know, so where the bicycles were going to be, what was going on, et cetera, et cetera. And we'd set up the cameras. I had come aboard this film because I had not worked with 35mm that much, and so I had suggested a French cameraman named Serge Agnirey, who had shot in 35 a lot, as the director of photography, and then I was the B camera operator, which was great for me because I got to use 1,000mm lenses and kind of wild things like that.
Yeah.
And so what we would do is we would rehearse, get the scene set, and then wait, and as the sun broke over the horizon and started sending beams of light down the highway, roll, and we'd start shooting in the most gorgeous light there is at sunrise, and we would, of course, go all the way through the day and shoot in sunset light. And so we got some very extraordinary footage of the racing. And Stephen had a couple of actors. One, Tony Bill, was one of the stars, and a guy named Roger Ernst was also in the picture at we shot all of the, I forget how many weekends, I think we shot 3 weekends of bicycle racing, and he had the most, all of the action of the race, and then the last weekend was going to be at a little intersection in Santa Monica that had a very nice small town look to it, and we were going to, Stephen wanted to shoot the opening of the film and the closing of the film, and the people, you know, cheering the riders on. And this was all to happen on that weekend, and he really went full tilt. We rented a Chapman crane. We had a Mitchell camera. We were set to shoot some very, very exciting stuff. And the only thing, the weather just did not get on his side. It not only rained, it monsooned the whole weekend. It was just a disaster. I mean, you couldn't see across the street in real life, let alone photograph it. And I mean, there is still footage from that day that of you know, startups of scenes, and there'd be sun, and the scene would just get underway, and then a cloud would come over, and in some cases, rain would start to fall. And it was just a complete frustration, and it was the end of his money. He and Ralph were out of money at that point. And quite frankly, the, you know, the picture was not finished. And it was one of those heartbreaking things. And I'll tell you the story later about what happened. But Stephen, of course, you know, you do not crush his spirit. He was looking in different other, you know, other projects and short films. And finally, I remember in 68, he called me up about a short film that he was going to do for a guy named Dennis Hoffman. And it was called Amblin. And it was something that he had spun off the top of his head when he got in to see Dennis. Dennis wanted to produce a film as he was a part owner of a special effects house. And so Dennis wanted to see if he could be a producer. And, of course, what he wanted to do was shoot a film in 16mm and then blow it to 35 because their company had just bought a 16-35 blow-up printer. But, of course, Stephen went along with this only so far and then said, no, we've got to shoot it in 35. And then all kinds of things had to be made, and we had to promise about how many takes we would shoot, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a concern because of how expensive it was going to be. But we proceeded to shoot Amblin 10 straight days, and this was in July of 1968. And we had this couple, because the story was, it was a little romantic film about a young couple that meet while they're hitchhiking through the desert, and they have a romance, and when they reach the ocean, etc., he acts like the kid that he is, and the girl, you know, looking at him, walks off and leaves. And it was just, a lovely picture, and it had elements of youth audiences. At the same time, it has a very, very old-fashioned romantic flavor to it, so it would appeal to adults. And we shot that picture, and I remember we would shoot, as always, sunrise every morning, and then we would shoot all day long, and then we would shoot sunset at night. And then we'd get in the car and drive to Technicolor over near Universal and see dailies from the day before. And then drive back, the poor producer would make everybody go to bed, and then we would get up, proceed to go to sleep and be up at 5 o'clock in the morning to get the sunrise. Because no matter how good the sunrise we got that yesterday morning was, there might be a better one this morning. And so it was always it was going through this incredible routine, and the nature of this couple hitchhiking and the romantic story gave us a chance to do some very romantic images. And it was also, you have to remember, 1968, and so this was a youth story. But again, I emphasize that while it was a 1968 youth movie, it was also very much a classic traditional film.
Right.
That's one of the things that appealed about it.
So tell me, what was apparent about Spielberg's talent even then to you?
Well, you couldn't miss it. I mean, the thing that, people ask about him, and I said, yes, you knew it the minute you met him, the minute he talked. You said, yeah, this is the real thing. This guy has really got it. And the way he not only dealt with the camera and all of the logistics, but the fact that he communicated so well with actors. And he had a good sense, a great sense of casting. And I noticed that there are a lot of people that would probably be superb filmmakers, but they don't have that immediate recognition of who is the right person to put in the film. Mm-hmm. And Steven did. And it was just, you got the idea, that his sensibilities were so perfectly suited to doing what he was doing. And on Amblin, we had shot on the little stage that Dennis Hoffman's company had, and we did the nighttime firelight scenes, etc., on that stage, and then we went out and did everything in the desert, and also then the ending was the day at the ocean. But it was a tremendous amount of work, and I can only say that what's not in the picture is astounding. In fact, I remember I'd tell Stephen, well, remember the scene that we did for Amblin, blah, 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 and it was like he would have no memory of it. It was something that hadn't worked for him, and he tossed it out, and that was it.
Right,
I might find it nostalgic, but he was strictly on to what was going to make that film work as a film.
I'm wondering, the conversations between the two of you, let's go ahead and start with E.T. When it comes to the pre-production phase and the planning of it, what conversations take place? What is that language? What do you guys need to understand?
Well, see, Steven, of course, what happened with Amblin was that it got him signed to Universal. And in those days, Universal was wonderful, and Steven was wonderful. They tried to get me signed at Universal, but in those days, if you were not born into the Cinematographers Union, you never got into it, was the rule then. In other words, you either had a father or a nephew who was a cinematographer, or forget it, you didn't become a cinematographer. And or you had some very good contacts in the film business. And so it was the kind of thing that you'd go in. I remember when I was 19 years old going into the office of the Cinematographers Guild and saying, I'd like to get an application for joining, and they sort of sneered at me. We don't have any applications. I said, but you're a labor union. You have to have applications for people who want to become members. And he goes, we don't need them here. That kind of thing. Basically, it was just get out. And I remember there was a guy in a baseball cap leaning against the counter, that said to me at the time, look, kid, just forget it. Find something else to do. You're never getting in this union. We're not going to allow it to happen. You know, I don't know his name, but I sure wish I did, because he's more responsible for me being a cinematographer than anybody else. It is just, you have to be told that that's something like that is impossible. So
yeah,
I had gone
yeah.
to work in commercials, and I was working in NABET companies at the time, and I was working with different people on lawsuits. We were involved in, I think I was involved in three different lawsuits. And finally, in 1975, a guy named Andy Davis, who's much better known now as a director of films, you know, than he is as a cinematographer, had found an attorney that was a terrific guy who has nothing to do with Hollywood, who was strictly a labor lawyer. And that guy said, no, you can't just sue the union. You've got to sue Contract Services Administration as well. You have to sue the producers that are handling the structure of the roster. Or otherwise you aren't going to get in. And that's where the malfeasance is. That's where they are breaking the law. So we filed that suit, and our attorney warned us it would probably be 2 to 3 years before it ever came to trial. But in just a year, we got a call or got letters from the union saying, if you can prove that you've worked 30 or more days for one production company, 90 or more days for all the production companies, union or non-union, and it was the first time that had ever happened. They said, "Bring proof of evidence is on you, and but bring your papers down." And it started a process. It took me 2 years of getting all of my work records before I went into more dusty warehouses with unhappy accountants who were helping me find the proof that I had worked all these days and different commercial companies and different things. But nonetheless, after 2 years, I did finally get into the union. And I did 2 days for Steven. He was doing some additional scenes for the redo, the new edition of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And I did the scene where they're out in the desert with the airplanes and the dune buggies, etc., and they find the freighter on its side out in the desert. And it was one of those things where that was great. It was great to work for Steven for just 2 days, and then he went off to England to prep Raiders of the Lost Ark. And by the time he got back, it was really wonderful because I had gotten into the union, and I was I had done two TV movies for a friend of ours named Jerry Friedman, and it was one of those things where Jerry saw Steven and says, "Hey, you know, you should see what you know Davio's been doing in these TV movies." And because he had come up with a rewrite of an old horror film screenplay called Night Skies, and Melissa Matheson, who was Harrison Ford's girlfriend at the time, later his wife, came up with a screenplay for it and said, "Steven, no, it shouldn't be out in the country. It should be in the suburbs. It should be this. It should be the kid and his family, etc." And lo and behold, she had a film called E.T. and Me. And Steven had taken the film back to Columbia, where Night Skies had been, you know, basically developed, and offered it to Columbia. And Columbia's reply, I've never forgotten, was, "Well, according to our research department, nobody over the age of 12 will ever go see this movie." And, so they passed. And
wow.
Steven then took it to Universal, and he took it to Sid Sheinberg, and Universal said, "Well, wait a minute, what's this going to cost? I mean, you know," Steven said, $10 million. They said, $10 million? Come on, you've got rocket ships and extraterrestrials and, you know, come on, not $10 million. He said, $10 million. And he made a deal with them that if he brought it in for $10 million, he would own half the picture.
Wow.
And so that was one of the great, great things. And we came in, and he needed a cameraman who was fast and cheap, and there I was, you know, relatively fast and very cheap. And it was the kind of thing that when we sat down and started talking about doing the movie, it was like getting together of looking at films again. And what was really great is we developed this thing of looking at movies that we both admired, but neither of us had anything to do with. And talked about things. You know, we were looking at the you know, footage by cameramen we really admired, like Vittorio Storaro and Caleb Deschanel and things like this. And Steven would say, "You think that's a filter, or is it smoke, or is it both?" You know. And so we were running these movies with the sound turned down, and I remember it was just utterly fascinating because we developed a dialogue, you know,
right,
about talking about images. And it was one of those things that he was very concerned about E.T. because here he was doing a movie which basically starred a rubber doll. And how was it not to be perceived as a rubber doll? And he knew we had to keep it in your E.T. in the dark for a great deal the beginning of the film. And it was only as we all got to know him that we began to see him more and more. And it was the kind of thing of I would go over to Carlo Rambaldi's place, and Carlo was building E.T., and, you know, I would borrow a friend's Aeroflex. He later says, you should buy me a new Aeroflex. I would borrow his and shoot footage of E.T., and it was always in the beginning, no matter how low-key I thought it was, he was, no, it's too bright. So we developed a technique of keeping E.T. in the dark. Basically, he was always backlit. He would have a glow in his eye. He would have just the tiniest little bit of bounce light on him, and that's the E.T. that you met at the beginning of the film. And it was quite something. The way we developed the look of the picture, and if you'll figure out, of course, that when you see it, that it's all kids and the mother, and the you don't see any other adults' faces in the film all the way through to the end, when you do get to meet Keys when you see him. But it was a thing of control, of making a special world, a children's world with their own extraterrestrial. Mm-hmm. And it was something that Stephen was extremely concerned about security on the picture, because he said, you know, we'll have this thing ready to come out, and somebody will hear, little boy's got an extraterrestrial in his closet, and they'll have a TV movie out in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was a big concern, and luckily it never happened. I don't think you'd ever find this to be the same in history again. But in 1981, when we were shooting that, nobody asked questions. If it didn't come out in the press release, the press at the time was not finding out about it, and so we kept it very secret. I remember we had one preview of the film. Stephen had shown the film as he cut it. Carol Littleton, and he would edit it, and he would show the film to friends of his and get very, very good response. And I remember we were getting ready to go into the lab with the picture, I think in April of 82, and we did. And then in May, Stephen decided we'd have one preview with an audience, and it was in Houston, Texas. And we flew to Houston, I remember, with an answer print. I mean, this is Stephen's confidence, man. His preview print is an answer print, cut negative and all. And we went to a very nice multi-cinema, and the main room, I think, held 800 people. And I had this beautiful new print, and I brought CC gel filters so that I could make sure the projector's color was exactly on. And everything. And I remember standing outside watching the people going into the theater, because they had no idea what they were going to see. They'd only been told that day that it was a Steven Spielberg film. And I looked at that audience going, and I said, you know, these would be the only people that ever see E.T. as a movie, because, you know, after it opens, it's going to be an event. And so it was the kind of thing of watching that audience. Henry Thomas was, his family lived in San Antonio. And they came over, he and his mom came over and saw the film with the preview audience, and it was just one of those wonderful things where the audience stayed in total silence through the whole beginning of the film and everything, including the boys playing Dungeons and Dragons, and then Elliot went down to the bottom of the driveway and got the pizza, and he hears the noise in the backyard, and he goes into the backyard and he puts the pizza down, and he walks over, and he's looking at the garden shed. And he takes a softball that's lying there and throws it into the garden shed. And when the softball flew back out, the roof blew off the theater. It was just...
I just watched it again last week. It's still such an overwhelming experience. There are just a few films in life that are truly magical, and E.T., that's one of them.
It's the kind of thing that I got to tell you. When we were making the film, we knew we had something really good. How big it was going to be, we really didn't have any idea. But when I went into the lab, and Carol and I started timing with Bob Rearing, our color timer at Technicolor, I would be sitting there, and I remember we were running just the cut work picture, which was there was no soundtrack. And there were two Technicolor vice presidents that were sitting in the theater with us. And I remember we got into the E.T. drinking the beer scene, and they were laughing so hard, one of them stood up, fell over in the aisle, and was roaring with laughter so much. I said, oh, boy, yep, this thing is going to be a hit. No
yeah.
question. And
I wanted to know, there's Spielberg was working on a budget, as you said, of $10 million, which
yeah.
I think was about half of what he had with Raiders, at least. What does
oh,
that do?
I think Raiders was more than 20, yeah.
You think it was?
Yeah, I do. Oh, God, the effects went on forever.
What does that do to you as a cinematographer?
It puts a tremendous amount of pressure on you.
Yeah.
Because, plus, this is a film that's all kids. So at 5:30, they come to you and say, that's it, no more kids, goodbye, and the kids have to go home. Mm-hmm. So then we're shooting with the mom. We're shooting with E.T., a lot with E.T., and different shots of E.T. from 5:30 to 7:30. We'd have that time to get the other footage. And it was just one of those things that the course of your day, you have a 12-hour day, but it's the nature of the thing where I would go to the lab every morning at 6 and see the dailies at Deluxe with Michael Crane, my daily supervisor, and then I would go over and we'd start at 7 of getting into the picture, and we would shoot like crazy, you know, as fast as we could, because it was all with kids and this creature and E.T., and every scene always started with, where is E.T. going to be? Because understand, the E.T. that you see the majority of the time is a solid statue. I mean, he has to be planted, and incredible numbers of cables have to come out of his body and go through the floor. The sets were all built on a rise. They were all built on a platform so that there was room underneath to feed the cables wherever we could place our, I think it was 11 people were operating E.T. mechanically. People to this day say to me, well, God, you could do it so much better now because you'd do it CGI. And I go, let me ask you something. If it was CGI, what would Drew Barrymore have had to look at age 6? Hey, Drew, just look at this spot on the green backing. No, she had a real creature there. All the kids had a real creature to look at and communicate with. And the Carlo and his crew were so dedicated. They would rehearse things just to do to get the kids excited before the take. And I mean, it was quite a sensational operation. And so we would go like crazy. I remember I would show dailies to the crew at noon. We would not let Steven see dailies at the Culver City Studios because the screening room was so bad. And we said, no, you wait till you get home. He had a beautiful screening room at his house at the time. And so at the end of the day shooting, Steven would always leave Carlo Rambaldi and Carlo's assistants with enough instructions that all the things that E.T. had to do tomorrow that he couldn't do today. And so we would leave, they'd be standing there dismantling E.T., and when we'd come in the next morning, they'd be just finishing putting him back together. Oh. They spent many all-night sessions.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, it was quite an effort.
There's something that, obviously, among his many attributes, there's something that always strikes me about Mr. Spielberg's films, and I'm not the only one to say this, obviously, but it's his mastery of framing and the activity within the frame. And I was speaking with a biographer of Mr. Spielberg's yesterday, and he said something very interesting.
McBride?
Yes.
McBride? Yeah,
yes,
oh, he's wonderful,
yes.
Yeah.
He said something interesting that the Spielberg was asked a question from a novice director, and she asked, "How do I decide what my shots will be?" And he said, "When you're watching your actors rehearse, wherever you find yourself standing, whatever position you're drawn to stand in and observe, that's the shot that you take." I thought it was so simple and so beautiful.
We refer to that as the magic spot.
Yeah.
And that's where the camera's going to go. And
yeah.
He will block, usually his master is shot with a wide-angle lens, and he will block the scene with that. And you then figure out how his coverage is going to play. And it is, what is so interesting is that he's not, he's rather a traditional guy in terms of the coverage you may use, but the lenses will be different than the classic coverage would have been. And he will find a way to make each shot speak through unusual lenses and unusual framing. And that's part of the magic. And when you're working with him, you're seeing, you learn to anticipate what is coming. Because I found when Stephen would start to rehearse, I had to start lighting. Once I established what windows I was going to be able to use to put light through, etc., I would start my light coming in, and I find this is a valuable thing two ways. One, I'm getting a jump on it. Two, actors get to feel where light is, and it helps them block themselves to each other, and it is often a great advantage as to what the placement of the light, that what you're doing is receiving cooperation from your performers. And but every performer who works for Stephen knows that they're going to be held to very tight standards as to where they're going to be, and when they lean in, how far that's going to be. And for the camera operator, it's extremely valuable to have subtle communication with actors so that he can give them real points of precision as to where they're going to land, because it's a complex thing for actors.
What strikes me, too, is, if I'm not mistaken, around this time he's relying less and less on storyboards.
Well, E.T. was very, very straightforward that way. The only things storyboarded in E.T. were the effect shots. And Kathy Kennedy, who was producing her first film, said, no, we have to have storyboards for the effect shots because we have to have the bids made by ILM on what the effect shots are going to cost based on some reality. So the effect shots were all storyboarded, and the rest, Stephen decided he'd rather not have the storyboard, but because he was dealing with kids, he wanted to have the freedom of movement for the actors that not storyboarding gave him. And so that picture was done, was, as Stephen said, he winged it. And that means he had thought about the ways he was doing it. He has the most phenomenal method making decisions in the course of blocking a scene that really make the scene work.
Okay. That's Alan Davia speaking about E.T.
That's incredible.
Isn't he amazing?
Yeah. I mean, that's really good. I mean, both of these interviews are really superb.
I got to share, I was trying to get Davia for a couple of weeks, and he was very agreeable. And every time I called the man, he was expecting a phone call or he was on an important phone call. I had the worst timing. And
right.
So I finally called him Friday afternoon. I said, I'm open whenever you are. I'm honored to have the opportunity to speak to you. So he said, all right, let's do it right now. So we made it work. And it helps that he's so infectious and enthusiastic about what he does. There's a couple of things, there's one important thing about what makes E.T. work so well emotionally and what makes the children's performance so real and emotional. And that is something that Spielberg never did before. He shot E.T. in sequence. So they meet E.T., they become accustomed to E.T., they grow to love him, and then they have to part. That all happened in real time. And so all of those emotions at that last shot of E.T. are absolutely authentic. Because Spielberg told them, you're never going to see E.T. again. And that's what came out.
Mm-hmm.
The only other movie he did that on was Private Ryan, shoot in sequence. And that makes sense with Private Ryan, too, because the harrowing nature of D-Day. These people were completely unprepared for this level of violence and menace.
Right.
That worked for that film to shoot that right at the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's relationships that take place and grow throughout the course of the midsection of that film, which
absolutely
is another very smart film, and very, very insightful about characters too. I was thinking, even the Matt Damon character in that film, the fact that he didn't go through D-Day,
right?
So he seems different. His outlook is a little different.
I have a confession to make about that, because he didn't go through D-Day, and it always takes me, he is Private Ryan, But he's not the first character I think of when I think of that film.
Right, right.
Does that make sense? I mean, I think
of
all the guys who we go on the journey with.
Yeah.
I mean, so I always, it takes me a couple, oh yeah, that's right, he's Private Ryan, but.
Exactly, yeah. Another great movie. But with E.T., I guess we'll close off with this tonight. What's your favorite moment from E.T., Jerry?
Oh, God. My favorite moment, and it's probably one that's the same with everybody, is when he says, you know, I'll be right here.
Right.
That's my favorite moment. I won't lie to you. That's my favorite moment in the whole film.
Well, you're not alone. It's one of our guests' favorite moments, too. And the other person's favorite moment, Mr. Davia, it happens to be my favorite moment from the movie. And he likes it for a different reason. But there's just this one fleeting moment where Drew Barrymore, where the older brother takes Drew Barrymore's doll away.
Oh, that's right.
She starts to cry, and then you see it from E.T.'s point of view, and his sympathies kind of go with the girl and her cries, and it's just a very slight little moment, kind of fleeting.
Mm-hmm.
But like so much of that movie, it feels so much like childhood. It just captures it.
Perfectly.
Know? Yeah. Yeah. Anything else you want to share about E.T. before we get this
another
closing?
Another scene I really like a lot, speaking of just childhood, I love the scene where he shows E.T. his room and everything.
Yeah.
Just showing all the stuff, like the Star Wars figures and everything and all the other stuff. I always love that scene.
Kid stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I just love it.
Pez, or is it Pez that he has and you eat it?
Yeah, the Pez.
The Pez dispenser.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I love all of that.
Yeah, yeah. And Harrison Ford is in the movie, as it
he's
is now.
He's on the DVD.
Just...
Isn't he on the DVD, the deleted scenes?
He's in a long deleted scene, or he has a long monologue. Obviously, he was, at the time, he was dating or already married to the screenwriter, Melissa Matheson.
That's right.
So that's a longer scene that he's in. But in the actual movie, I think you see his body in the scene in the classroom where all the frogs jump out or something. Maybe
mm-hmm.
it's that scene. I'm not certain which scene it is, but it's interesting stuff. We're going to close the show now. We thank everyone for joining us tonight. We'll be back Wednesday night with actor Michael Rapaport and another guest we're trying to line up as well. Empire of the Sun will be in January. We'll continue our Spielberg tribute then. And we're going to close off with the favorite movie moments from E.T. from our two guests, starting with, this is really interesting, starting with Mr. Davia. Thanks, everyone, for joining us, and we will
thank you, everyone.
See you Wednesday night. Thanks so much. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
E.T. probably is the shot of the kids in the closet looking at E.T. This is just after Gertie and Michael have come into the room and all hell breaks loose and... you know, they've got E.T. runs into the closet and he's by his little yellow lamp and everything, and the kids are standing there and the stained glass window is behind them. And I always love to tell the story because I had said early in the game, I said, I at home I have a closet that has a window in it. Thank God, it's there. I said, with all that happens in this closet, let's have a window in the closet. And Jim Bissell, the production designer, said, how about a stained glass window? And I said, oh, let's show it to us, and et cetera. And that window with the yellow and the gold squares and so on that's in it, that was what Jim Bissell came up with. And I see that window in the background and the kids with warm light on their face, and it's just they're all looking at E.T., and it's whew.
Yeah.
Yep. Ugh. That shot, that does it.
E.T., I suppose the ending, it's, you know, I teach screenwriting, and I think it's a classic example of good screenwriting when E.T. says, come, he wants the boy to go with him on the spaceship, and then the boy says, stay, and then they realize that neither can do what they want, they can't be together, and then E.T. says, ouch, which is a beautiful line of dialogue that expresses a lot of feeling. And it's a very serious adult kind of ending that, you know, you can't always, you know, life is disappointing, but that's one reason the ending is so deeply moving is that it stirs the most profound emotions you have about loss and love and families and everything.
Thank you.